supposedly encounter no treacherous terrain. The enormous meadow is in places runneled, and the grass stands 18 inches high. Even in this cool night, from time to time, feeble swarms of winged insects, too dimly glimpsed to be identified in the moonlight, are disturbed out of the land, clicking their brittle wings and body shells ineffectively against the Rhino GX. Pedro has established his surveillance post within a grove of cottonwoods. In the pale moonlight, the trees loom blacker than the starshot sky. Godfrey is the last to arrive. Among the trees, in addition to the Explorer, stands the 800-horsepower Cadillac Escalade, customized by Specialty Vehicle Engineering, assigned to Paloma Sutherland and Sally Jones. Here also are a Jeep Wrangler with the Poison Spider package from Four Wheel Parts, an aftermarket builder, which is shared by Rupert Baldwin and Vince Penn, as well as the bespoke Range Rover by Overfinch, assigned to Christopher Roberts and Janice Dern. In an operation like this, undertaken in a small town, it's important to split the team among various vehicles so that they don't appear to be related and are less likely to call attention to themselves than would a group of outsiders traveling together. The 5 men and 3 women are gathered at the Explorer, half-seen shadows within the deep moon shadows of the cottonwoods, conversing softly, when Godfrey leaves the Rhino GX and joins them. The grove of trees stands 30 yards from the county road and directly across from the entrance to Ansel and Claire Hawk's ranch. Godfrey has seen film of the ranch. At its entrance, the private access road is flanked by stone posts supporting an arch of wrought iron incorporating the name Hawk. A single lane of blacktop, bordered by ranch fencing and overhung by live oaks, proceeds 150 yards through rich grassland to the ranch buildings. From this distance, in daylight, the main residence, stables, barn, and manager's house can't be seen beyond the screening oaks. During the day, with binoculars, Pedro and Alejandro took turns watching the sole entrance to and exit from the ranch. Now they monitor the place with ATN PVS-7-3 night vision goggles, mil-spec Generation 4 gear, which gather in all available light across the spectrum and magnify it 80,000 times. At 7:30 this morning, Pedro tells Godfrey, Ansel and Claire left for church in their Ford F-550. 3 minutes later, Juan and Marie Saba followed in their pickup. Are you sure they were just going to church? We have a portable satellite dish. Even out here, it links us to the internet. Then we backdoor NSA audio feed from both houses. Godfrey has to admit the unknown playwright deserves praise for a quaint detail like church, which adds verisimilitude to this Texas setting that has otherwise at times seemed thinly sketched. Alejandro Lobo says, Juan and Marie returned from church at 9:26. After church, Ansel and Claire remained in town to have breakfast. They returned to the ranch at 10:35. They've been there ever since, Pedro added. What's the situation now? Quiet in both houses, Alejandro reports. The Sabas went to bed early. The Hawks watched Sunday magazine. What was their reaction? Infuriated, sickened, helpless. He said he was going to get good and drunk. She took an Ambien. As far as we can tell, they both knocked themselves out for the night, one way or the other. As far as you can tell. Evidently, supposedly, as we are asked and expected to believe, Godfrey replies. Sir? Alejandro says in puzzlement, and his twin asks, You think we missed something? No. No, Godfrey assures them. He turns to the other 6 half-seen figures that might be only spirits in a Shakespearean drama, the black cottonwood shapes like some grove of yew trees where the sorrowing dead gather to lament their passing. Let's gear up, people. No engine noise to alert them. We're going on foot. In the cargo space of the Explorer are Kevlar vests and bullet-resistant helmets. They strip off their jackets and shoulder rigs to put on the vests, and then rearm themselves. Although Ansel and Claire Hawk are gunned up, Godfrey and his crew do not want to kill anyone, merely enslave them with nanotech. Chapter 10. Shortly before midnight, weighed down with weariness, vision blurring from lack of sleep, Jane paid cash for a motel room in Lathrop, California. She always wanted a king-size bed, not because she tossed and turned in her sleep, which she didn't, and not because she liked to keep a pistol within easy reach under a pillow adjacent to her own, which she did. For 6 years, she and Nick had slept in a king-size bed. Whenever she had come half awake in the night, she had reached out to find him. On touching him, she had always felt safe from the storms of life and quickly fell back into sleep. He wasn't there to be touched anymore. But as long as she left a space for him, when she reached out in the dark, his pillow and his share of the sheets were waiting for him. If drowsy enough, she could believe that he'd gotten up for a moment and would soon come back to warm the bed beside her, whereupon dreams returned to her soft and easy. But if even sleep-sodden, she realized that he was gone from her world forever. This provision of mattress consoled her with the thought that on some inconceivable shore beyond this life, he remained her Nick, his love undiminished, and saved a space for her. Although exhausted, she feared that she would lie awake for so long that she might have to get up and dress and drive on, but when her head touched the pillow, sleep instantly claimed her. On this difficult night, she expected sleep to be filled with scenes of her child in peril, but instead she dreamed of ships at sea and buses and trains. On the ship, her fellow passengers were the sinister strangers of anxiety dreams. On the train, they were Gavin Washington, his wife Jessie, Nathan Silverman, Jane's former mentor at the Bureau, and her mother, all dead in the world of the waking. But here, journeying together toward... No, not yet, Jane told her mother. Not yet. Not even for you. She disembarked from the train to board a bus on which other passengers included the two serial killers she killed on a lonely farm, a dark web entrepreneur she'd killed in self-defense, and J.J. Crutchfield, the collector of women's eyes whom she had wounded and captured, who died in prison. More than once, she reached out to the empty side of the bed, and each time she fell back to sleep, but always, there was another bus, a train, a ship at sea. Chapter 11. The high moon, a silver coin in the sequined purse of the night, the shabby Lathrop Motel poorly lighted in recognition of the fact that a swirl of neon and a declaration of vacancy at this late hour will not induce a single additional traveler to make his bed there. Parked across the street from those grim lodgings, Ivan Petro does the math for murder, but isn't able to make it work. The motel has 15 units. The number of vehicles suggests that only 6 rooms are rented. Considering that Jane Hawk is in one room, there are as few as 5 other guests, or as many as 10. In an apartment above the motel office, one or two owner-operators of the establishment lie in uneasy sleep, troubled by dreams of bankruptcy. As few as 6 people other than Jane, or as many as 12. If it was 6, or even 7, he might start in the apartment and kill his way to her room, eliminating potential witnesses. With a lock release device, he can slip through any door without much noise. If he wears night vision goggles, the gloom of bedrooms will not render him blind. He can kill fast and quietly with a knife. As skilled as the Hawk bitch is at self-defense, capturing her will involve some struggle, some noise, so that he can't move against her while other motel guests, on hearing an altercation, might call 911. There are 4 reasons why Ivan excels at what he does. First, He is much smarter than other Arcadians in his cell of the Cabal. Second, he possesses not merely a passion, but also an intellectual basis for the destruction of the historic order and the imposition of a utopia run by a ruling elite. He has read all of Nietzsche, Max Weber, and Freud, so he understands how efficient and stable society would be if all the delusions of meaning and illusions of free will were stripped from the confused masses. Third, he detests those Arcadians who have thus far kept him out of the highest circles of the revolution, and he hates himself for his failure to ascend. And all this anger is jet fuel for his ambition, ensuring that he works harder than anyone else. Fourth, he has great patience. He is not a hot-headed rebel, not a wild-eyed anarchist whose ideology is so tightly wound that he rushes into action with a war cry. Under these conditions, the risk of trying to take Jane Hawke is too great. He can wait. A better moment will come. His wristwatch has an alarm function. He sets it for 5 a.m. There are no street lamps where he is parked. He powers his seat into a reclining position. He closes his eyes, and, because he is a man who cares about no one but himself and is too certain of his future to worry about himself, he falls asleep in seconds. Chapter 12. Pedro and Alejandro remain behind with the vehicles in the grove of cottonwoods. Vince Penn, an army tank on legs, wearing night vision goggles, leads the way through the meadow as insects sing to the moon. Carrying the MedExpress container, Paloma Sutherland is second in the procession. Egon Gottfried is third, and the remaining four members of the team follow single file behind him. At this late hour, the road is so devoid of traffic that it seems no longer to lead anywhere that man or machine still exists. Broken, lane-dividing lines glow softly like some coded message to be deciphered. The team doesn't approach the house on the private lane, which might invite discovery. They climb the fence and continue overland. The wind that sprang up at sundown has blown away to the west, leaving a stillness in its wake. The two-story white-clabbered main residence stands under old canopied oaks. Lights glow at downstairs and upstairs windows. The Hawks are evidently up late, in spite of Ambien and Scotch. Ansel's Ford F-550 truck stands in a graveled parking area. The stables and barn are dark, as is the residence of the ranch manager, a barely visible geometric form 300 yards to the northwest. The silence is deeper than elsewhere, bereft of insect song. They take positions all around the house, except for Paloma, who stands aside with the MedExpress container. Rupert and Chris climb the back porch steps, while Vince and Gottfried move on the front. They have lockade lock-release guns that defeat the deadbolts with little noise. There is no alarm, for the Hawks believe themselves to be self-sufficient in matters of self-defense. They are Texans, after all, and they are ranchers. If they weren't born with full knowledge of firearms, they were born with a predisposition to learn. Any of Gottfried's team could be shot dead, including Egon himself. Guns drawn, Egon and Vince venture into the lighted foyer as Rupert and Chris enter by the kitchen door. Earlier, they memorized the layout of the house from plans imported to their laptops. Rupert and Chris will clear the ground floor. Vince and Gottfried move directly to the stairs and ascend. The house is solidly constructed, but they make some noise. Yet they arrive in the upstairs hallway without encountering anyone. Every open door is a danger, every closed door yet a greater threat. If you believe you are a physical being and can therefore die. Vince has a fine sweat on his brow. Egon Gottfried remains dry. They clear the second floor room by room, but they find no one. Returning to the stairs, Gottfried sees Rupert and Chris in the foyer below. Chris shrugs, and Rupert looks disgusted. Then, to the enormous barn. Click on the lights. Dust motes like galaxies spiraling, the scent of hay. In one corner, the Hawks keep two other vehicles, a Chevy sedan and a Ford SUV. Both are here. Vince Penn is big and powerful and stalwart, but the unknown playwright has chosen to make him the slowest intellect on the team. He blathers his way to a conclusion that is instantly obvious to everyone else.
Hey, you think maybe they left on horseback? Could be, huh? If they went on horseback, you know, they could escape overland. Then Pedro and Alejandro wouldn't know they slipped out.
Onward to the stables. As light blooms, horses swing their heads over stall doors and nicker. 8 stalls, just 3 horses. How damn many horses do they have? Godfrey wonders. If they rode out on horseback, the ranch manager will know where they went. The manager's residence is reached by a single lane of blacktop cracked by weather and crumbling along the edges. Dark without and within, the craftsman-style bungalow shelters under another oak. Godfrey intends to invade it as they did the previous house. However, when they are still about 15 yards from the place, every window brightens, and exterior lamps shed cones of light as well. They halt as the front door opens. Recognizable from the photographs in the NSA's Jane Hawk file, Juan and Maria Saba step out of the bungalow. He is holding what might be a .22 rifle, and she grips a long-bladed machete. Godfrey is familiar with the concept of humor, though he doesn't find much that is humorous in his scripted existence. He's amused, however, by this couple's intention to stand off 7 heavily armed professionals with these pathetic weapons. From the door behind the Sabas appear 2, 4, 8 other men and women, all with more impressive weaponry. And from around each side of the bungalow come others, male and female, a few teenagers, all bearing firearms, some also outfitted with machetes and scabbards. About half of them seem to be Hispanic. Among this solemn little army of citizen soldiers, none appears to be amused, and in fact, Godfrey can't maintain his own smile. How long has this crowd gathered in silence, so that Pedro and his brother, monitoring the premises, have heard not a word spoken?
"We want no trouble," Juan Saba says. "Leave now."
FBI, Godfrey declares, rather than flashing his homeland credentials. FBI has more history, more glamour, and is taken more seriously than Homeland Security.
"We're here with arrest warrants."
They possess no warrants, but a lie is not a lie when there's no such thing as truth. Words are merely words, used like tools. He holds his ID high for them to see.
"Put down your weapons."
"FBI," Saba says.
"Yes, FBI, we are supposed to believe."
Interesting. Saba seems to be expressing the doubt of one who, like Godfrey, embraces radical philosophical nihilism. This would appear to suggest that his mind is as real as Egon's.
"Some here are brave uncles, aunts, cousins," Juan Saba says. "Some are neighbors, brave friends of Mr. and Mrs. Hawk, and friends of Jane."
"Jane Hawk," Godfrey declares, "is guilty of multiple murders and treason. Anyone who assists her now is an accessory after the fact and will be charged and brought to trial."
There are maybe 30 people arrayed in front of the house, not one face clouded with either anger or fear, all expressionless, as if they mean to convey that their resistance isn't driven by emotion, which might wane under pressure, that it is motivated by loyalty or justice or some equally noble virtue. Into their challenging silence, Godfrey says,
"If you insist on standing with a traitor and murderer, if you won't help us find Ansel and Claire, I'll call for backup. You can't outlast a federally imposed siege of this property. Get real, Mr. Saba."
After half a minute of silence, perhaps intended to establish that he is unmoved by this threat, Juan Saba says,
"You don't want a big, loud thing here. You come with your needles to make slaves of Ansel and Claire. Such devil's work can be done only in the quiet dark. They aren't here anymore. You can't force us to help you find them. We'll make much noise and shine the light of justice on you."
This is a twist that Egon Gottfried hasn't seen coming. Jane has told her in-laws about the brain implants, and they have shared this with Juan Saba, who shared it with these others. And they are all credulous enough to believe this mind-control story to be a fact. Rupert Baldwin has little patience for the pretensions of common folk like this, who believe in the myth of constitutional rights. Loud enough for Saba to hear, he says, "We're not going to allow this bunch of shit-kickers to push us around, are we?" Godfrey has no objection to a shootout. His physical existence is an illusion. He can't be killed. It would be interesting to see how such a close-quarters pitched battle might turn out. However, just as he can somehow see, hear, feel, taste, and smell with this illusion of a physical body, he can also experience pain. Godfrey has no copy of the script. It always seems that the unknown playwright trusts him to intuit what he is expected to say and do. Godfrey has come to believe that when his intuition isn't keen enough to discern what is wanted of him, the unknown playwright inflicts pain, in one form or another, to encourage him to try harder to be true to the narrative in the future. Godfrey and his crew are not clad head to foot in Kevlar. A lot of pain can be inflicted with a leg wound, with an arm wound. In Godfrey's experience, clandestine action is what is usually expected. He isn't likely to be rewarded for instigating a shootout. Saba says, "These friends will be with Maria and me while we do chores and oversee the day workers, and while we sleep. We won't be taken by surprise. We won't be easy." "Even if they went on horseback," Godfrey says, "we have ways of tracking them, ways of finding them." "Then go to your ways," Saba advises. "You'll live to regret this." "There is no regret in doing right. Go to your ways."
"Arrogant shit kicker," Rupert Baldwin snarls.
Before the situation might spiral out of control, Godfrey orders his people to concede and return to the Grove of Cottonwoods. When they are with Pedro and Alejandro, wrapped in the fabric of cottonwood shadows threaded by moonlight, he takes the MedExpress container from Paloma and sends his people back to their motels. Only Rupert Baldwin is given a task, which it is hoped he can complete before noon. Rupert is brilliant at tracking quarry through the millions of tearless, blinkless eyes that monitor the country's buildings and streets, that observe from security cameras in reeking alleyways and from satellites in airless orbit. Furthermore, Rupert is reliably quick and vicious in the face of any threat. They will find Ansel and Claire soon enough, and in time, the Sabas, Juan and Maria, will be humbled and cruelly used. And why not? Like everyone else, the Sabas are merely concepts that can't be proven real, symbols that can never be deciphered, figments, meaningless distortions of light. Chapter 13. Cornell Jasperson knew many things, such as he knew thousands of books because he had devoted his life to reading. On his five-acre property stood a shabby little blue stucco house with a white metal roof shaded by unkempt queen palms. Set back from the house, a forbidding ramshackle barn seemed to tremble on the verge of collapse. Cornell Jasperson knew, as few people did, that the barn was structurally sound and that within it, accessible only through steel doors with electronic locks, was a library for the end of the world. As he walked through that library now, He knew it remained as precious as he had intended it to be when he had it built, but he also knew it was no longer as safe a refuge as it had seemed before. The hidden, windowless, 40-foot-square library was lined with 1,300 linear feet of bookshelves on three walls and part of the fourth. Four intricately figured Persian carpets warmed the polished concrete floor. Many seating options, chairs and recliners, no two of the same style or period. He knew the layout so well that, when reading, he could move from one sitting place to another that better suited his mood, without taking his eyes from the page. Side tables and footstools, lamps, 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 table lamps, floor lamps, shades of stained glass by Tiffany, blown glass, etched glass, colored and cut crystal. Cornell loved light filtered and softened by color and texture, and this library lay bejeweled with light. Cornell knew that civilization was a shaky construct, that many civilizations had collapsed throughout world history. He knew, or at least believed, that the current civilization would collapse. He was what they called a prepper, prepared for the end, ready to ride out 30 months of chaos and violence during which a new civilization might rise out of the ruins of the current one. Within the 600,000 forbidding acres of the Anza-Borrego Desert State Park, little Borrego Springs was the only town. And at this southern end of Borrego Valley, the residences were few. When the distant cities lost power, water, and access to gasoline, when the food distribution network collapsed, millions would perish. The desperate survivors might seek fertile, defendable land, but they would have no reason to trek all the way to the parched and barren wastes of the Anza-Borrego. Here, at least, there would be no need to stave off savage hordes. Anyway, the library was not where he would hunker down during the days of blood and terror. This treasury of books served as his waiting place, hidden away from the world, but not as grim as the underground bunker, where, at the penultimate moment, he would take refuge via a well-concealed secret passageway, living under the world like the Phantom of the Opera or some troll. Cornell knew that most people thought he was strange, even creepy. He'd been diagnosed with Asperger's disorder and various forms of autism. Maybe all those diagnoses were correct, or maybe none were. His IQ was very high, and he'd made a lot of money while sitting alone in a room, developing apps that had proved enormously popular. When he was rich, no less than when he'd been poor, people thought he was strange, even creepy. 6'9", long-boned, knob-jointed, with large and ill-set shoulder blades that he thought were reminiscent of the plates on the backs of certain dinosaurs, with strong hands large enough to juggle honeydew melons, or human heads. Cornell knew that over the years he had frightened many people who entered his presence unexpectedly. A few had been unable to fully repress a startled cry of fear. His cousin, Gavin, and Gavin's wife, Jessica, insisted that he had a sweet, round face like a milk chocolate brown baby Jesus, and a few other people told him similar things, that they were probably just being kind. When Cornell looked at himself in a mirror, he couldn't tell if his reflection might be pleasant or fearsome. His face was his face, so he was too familiar with it to reach a final conclusion. Sometimes he thought he looked like that black actor, Denzel Washington, but at other times he thought, Frankenstein. Cornell knew that women would never chase after him like they probably chased Denzel. He would forever be a target of snarky teenage boys and drunkards with something to prove. But that was okay. As part of his personality disorder, or whatever it was, he couldn't tolerate being touched anyway. He was happiest alone with a book. As Mr. Paul Simon had sung, "I am a rock, I am an island." Anyway, Cornell knew all that, and a great deal more, but he did not know what he should do about the boy. He stopped beside the recliner, where Travis was lying curled upon himself, sleeping in the golden light of a Tiffany lamp. 5 years old. Cornell could hardly believe that he had ever been as small as this child. Travis was scarily little, like he could break apart if he just rolled off the recliner. Now that Gavin and Jessica had gone away and not come back, the boy had no one to take care of him except a shambling, misassembled man who didn't know how to take care of anyone except himself. Gavin and Jessica's dogs, big, dangerous-looking dogs, German shepherds, had come with Travis. Now they padded through the library to stand on the farther side of the recliner, watching Cornell as Cornell watched the boy, as if they thought he might try to harm Travis. Cornell said,
"Don't bite or claw me, please and thank you."
The dogs said nothing, though their eyes seemed to speak volumes, mostly regarding their distrust for this big, strange man.
"I never had dogs," he told them. "I never had a son. Can't have a son if I can't tolerate being touched, even a woman's touch."
The dogs cocked their heads, as if considering this revelation.
"I like to be alone,"
the boy murmured in his sleep.
"Or I thought I did," Cornell said.
Chapter 14. Egon Gottfried behind the wheel of the huge Rhino GX, headlights cleaving the prairie dark ahead, infinite blackness to both sides of the county road, the soft glow of the instrument panel and the hum of tires on blacktop, so convincing that he can almost believe the car and the road and the night are real. In time, Worsted again, as barely sketched as some town in a low-budget western, the buildings mere facades, no citizens afoot after midnight, a lone and bold coyote slinking past the dark drugstore, eyes radiant in the headlights. Gottfried is neither angry nor even disappointed about the turn of events at Hawk Ranch. In this honeycomb of illusions that is his existence, nothing matters enough to warrant strong emotions. Having passed his motel, Gottfried doesn't know where he is going. He is only along for the ride. He is not surprised, however, when he passes Nashville West, pulls to the curb half a block from the roadhouse, switches off the lights, and kills the engine. Although closing time must be approaching, several vehicles remain in the parking lot. When he gets out of the Rhino GX, Gottfried hears country music, a live band, not a jukebox. Eat, drink, music. He moves to a corner of the roadhouse where a burned-out light welcomes shadows and those who need them. The wait is not a long one. A weather-bitten man in cowboy boots, faded jeans, a checkered flannel shirt, and a white Stetson exits Nashville West. He is singing with a slur the song that the band just finished playing. Even someone who believes in the reality of all things as they appear might think this man is too much of a walking cliché to be real. He approaches, what else, a Ford pickup on which is fixed a bumper sticker that declares Texas true. "Hey, cowpoke," says Gottfried, stepping close behind the man. He thumbs the button on the handle of a collapsible baton. The instrument instantly telescopes out to 20 inches, and he raises it high. When Wyatt Earp turns to favor him with a loose smile, Gottfried hammers the steel knob at the end of the baton into his whiskey-flushed face. The crunch of bone crush, the rush of freed blood, the shock of sudden sobriety in the widening eyes, the Stetson spinning up as the cowpoke folds down, denim and flannel to blacktop. Gottfried hammers the arms raised in defense, fingers snapping like breadsticks, and knocks out of the man the feeble cry for help that is more of a wretched gagging than it is a shout. 5 blows later, the task complete, Egon Gottfried thumbs the button which collapses the baton. He returns to the Rhino and drives away. His heart rate is maybe 60 beats per minute. He isn't breathing hard. What he's done required little effort and no anger or other strong emotion. The cowboy, like everyone and everything else, means nothing to him. Godfrey isn't angered by the turn of events at Hawk Ranch, and he harbors no spite, certainly no rage, against the stranger in the roadhouse parking lot. As always, he merely intuits what the script requires of him. He is not an independent agent. There is no objective basis from which to determine what is true or real. Consequently, nothing is true or real except his mind. He is only along for the ride. Chapter 15. A departing guest slammed a door. Jane half woke in the motel room in Lathrop after 5 hours of sack time. She lay for a while in the dark, in a slowly dissolving web of sleep, trying to imagine that she had only dreamed the death of her husband and the danger to her child, that she had herewith awakened into a world where she and Nick and Travis still lived in Virginia, facing a future filled with the promise of peace and grace. She possessed an ability to adapt quickly to change and threat, though not by resorting to denial, at which she was no good at all. She threw aside the blanket, swung her legs out of bed, and knew this was still a world of murder, slander, envy, theft, deceit, and implacable evil, where peace must be won each day, where legions didn't know grace, or, perceiving it, thought it mere weakness. Having showered the previous evening, she dressed and made herself up to look like the photo on another of the forged driver's licenses she possessed, this one in the name of Eleanor Dashwood. When all this began, she had shoulder-length blonde hair, which was now cut short. She pulled on a pixie-cut chestnut-brown wig. Non-prescription contact lenses morphed her blue eyes brown. Stage-prop glasses with black frames gave her a studious appearance. A successful disguise was a simple one. The reflection in the bathroom mirror wouldn't fool her son, but she didn't look enough like the traitor in the news to be recognized on the street. No casual disguise could deceive the facial recognition software married to security systems in airports, train stations, and bus depots, which was why she could travel only by car. She loaded her luggage into her Explorer Sport, a stolen and remade vehicle without GPS, purchased with cash from an off-market dealer in Arizona. She drove out of Lathrop, south, on Interstate 5. Hours later, she left the interstate for a truck stop, filled the SUV's tank, and bought takeout, ham sandwiches, black coffee. She ate in the Explorer, in a remote corner of the parking lot, far from easy observation by all the drivers coming and going. She was still more than an hour north of Los Angeles, in this busy plot of commerce aswarm with trucks and other vehicles, the magnificent and sparsely populated San Joaquin Valley all around, and the blue sky, as serene as the world under it could never be. She used one of her burner phones to call another disposable that she'd left with a friend who had lost his wife and one of his two daughters in this secret civil war. He was now hiding out in Texas. His name had been linked to hers in the news. When Luther Tillman answered on the third ring, she said, "Just me."
"Best two words I've heard in days, knowing you're out there."
"Good to hear your voice, too." In metropolitan areas, the National Security Agency had planes that could be launched to scoop telecom signals from those carrier waves reserved for disposable cell phones and apply track-to-source technology to locate terrorists communicating in the run-up to an attack. Neither Jane nor Luther was in a metro area. There was no chance this conversation would be monitored in real time by anyone. Nevertheless, they used no names and spoke discreetly. What was impossible yesterday might have become possible today. Referring to Luther's daughter, Jolie, who had almost been injected with a control mechanism, whose sister and mother were now enslaved and lost to her, Jane said, "How's the girl?"
"Angry. But not angry with me anymore for getting involved in this. She knows I really had no choice. She's smart. Resilient."
"So how are you?"
Not good. Feeling lost. But hanging in there.
Jane took a breath to speak, hesitated, shuddered, and took another breath. Man, I so hate what I'm about to do.
If there's any way I can help, tell me. I'm going a little crazy here. Being off duty, it's not me.
Julie needs you there.
She wants them crushed for what happened to her mom and sister. She wants that real bad. I want to give her that.
And if she loses you, too?
If we don't blow this wide open, she not only loses me, she loses herself, her future, her freedom.
Jane sat in silence for a moment, watching a large motorhome negotiate the parking lot. Then she said, "You know what's the most important thing in the world to me?"
"Yeah. You showed me the cameo."
"Now I need to go into a very tight place and get him out of there before they find him. I'm not able to do it alone."
"Oh, shit."
"Yeah." Neck deep.
"Where are you? Where do you need me to be?"
"My friends, where you are now, they'll fly you to Palm Springs tomorrow morning, then drive you to Indio." She gave him an address.
"What do I need to bring?"
"What you used to carry every day to work," she said. He'd been a sheriff in Minnesota, and whatever else he might have brought to work every day, he always carried a gun. She said, "First thing after we hang up, have someone there take a photo of you, a headshot." She gave him an email address. On the subject line, put "emergency." The only message should be, "You're expecting the attached photo." Luther read the email address, and she confirmed it.
"You better believe we'll do this," he said, "no matter what it takes."
"I believe. I have to, or otherwise fall apart," she said. "With you, I believe we will. We'll do it." He said,
"I owe you for what I have left, for Jolie. I love you for that."
"You're the best. Just stay cool."
"Hell, I've had ice in my veins for days now."
Chapter 16. In the distant southeast, tilled fields moist from irrigation, issuing a thin mist from the respiring earth. Much nearer, and to the south, a weedy field leading to an open grove of live oaks. In the truck stop parking lot, Jane reviewed her options one more time, the people from whom she might seek help. She needed someone in addition to Luther Tillman. Her preference among the possibilities was an unlikely choice, but she kept returning to him. A week earlier, in Texas, she had been driving the desert night in a black Ford Escape when a Texas Highway Patrol officer pulled her over. She'd left him cuffed to her vehicle, which had been hot once it had been connected to her, and made off with his cruiser, a black and white Dodge Charger. Certain that she couldn't outrun the roadblocks, she'd used the patrol car's light bar to pull over a Mercedes E350, intending to take the car and use the driver as cover, because the police would be looking for a woman alone. She hadn't expected that she and the 81-year-old widower who owned the E350, Bernie Rigowitz, would spend more than 12 hours together, or that they would bond so completely. Now she took from her wallet a photo of his late wife that he'd given her, with whom he'd driven all over the country on extended road trips. Miriam was lovely, her face a portrait of kindness. Jane called Bernie's cell number. When he answered, she said, "I'm looking at this picture of Miriam you gave me, and I can't help asking myself, how did a guy like you win over a doll like her?"
"I'm no plusher, so I won't say I was a double for Cary Grant back then, but I was sweet as halva. Halva and chutzpah can take a guy a long way. Plus, I could dance a little. How's by you, Alice?"
She had told him that her name was Alice Liddell, because he never followed the news.
"Fah, it's all lies, or depressing."
He hadn't known she was the most wanted fugitive in America, only that she was,
mixed up in something you need to mix yourself out of.
Maybe by now, Jane said, you know more about me.
Oh, you're everywhere. I know all kinds of schmances about you now. I might believe 1% of it if I was stupid. But anyone wants me to spill anything about you, they can go talk to the wall.
You're a peach. Where are you, Bernie?
I'm here in Scottsdale with Nasia and Segev making over me. Everything ipsy-pipsy, but...
Nasia was his daughter, Segev, his son-in-law. But, she said.
But they want me to stop traveling, move in here, be pampered to death. They think Miriam's in that grave. They won't understand. She's out there everywhere we ever went together all those years of driving. I'm not lonely on the road, 'cause she's always with me.
Nasia is your only child, isn't she?
My best blessing now that Miriam's gone. So I have to pretend maybe I'll give up the road, which I won't.
You know, I have such a blessing, too.
Do I know? Since I found out, I can't sleep for worry. You never mentioned when we had our little drive together.
You didn't know who I was then. My kid is suddenly in a very bad jam. I can't get him. Speaking about her helplessness brought a tightness to her chest, a knot of emotion that made it hard to speak for a moment. I can't get him out of this jam alone.
The way you talk, a person would think I'm a stranger. You can't just tell me what I should do?
It's going to be damn dangerous. I have no right.
Are we mishpacha or what?
I don't know what that means.
What it means is, it means family.
That's very sweet, but in fact, we aren't family.
I know my own family, Bubbla. Who is and who's not. Didn't you call me Grandpa one day in Texas? And didn't I tell that nice policeman you were my granddaughter?
So then, it's settled.
Tell me what, when, where.
Under that serene blue sky, on the tumultuous surface of the earth, as long as there were Bernies and Luthers, there was hope. Jane said, you and Miriam traveled sometimes in a motorhome.
We took most trips by car, some in a Fleetwood South wind. It's a different country one way from the other, but always beautiful.
You could still drive a motorhome?
Can I walk? Can I talk? Can I twiddle my thumbs? I could drive you coast to coast without a bump.
What size was that Fleetwood of yours?
32 feet, but I can do longer. Gas is better than diesel. A diesel pusher, engine and back, will be a lot heavier and harder to turn. Where are we going?
Tell you tomorrow. Let's meet in Indio, near Palm Springs. She gave him the address. Can you be there tomorrow afternoon?
Indio's 5 hours from here. I could be there and back and there again with time to stop for a nosh. You got a motorhome?
I'll have one. From Enrique, the guy we visited in Nogales that time. Meanwhile, have someone take a photo of you, a headshot. She gave him the email address that she'd given to Luther.
Don't you worry, Bernie said. Whatever we need to do, we'll do it twice.
There's no way I can ever thank you enough, Bernie.
So before you hang up, say the word for me.
What word?
What we are, and always will be.
Her voice caught again in her throat. Mishpoka.
Pretty good. You should let that kh rattle against the roof of your mouth a little better, but not bad for a first try, Bubbla.
Chapter 17. Godfrey never sleeps more than a few hours. He doesn't know why he needs any sleep. Sleep is a requirement of the body, and his body isn't real. A disembodied mind should function without sleep. But he isn't the author of this drama, isn't responsible for the conflicting details that suggest a careless playwright. He is only along for the ride. After a late breakfast in the Holiday Inn coffee shop, he walks 2 blocks to the Best Western, where Rupert Baldwin is staying. The sky over Worsted is woolly and gray. The air pools in stillness. but a pre-dawn breeze earlier smoothed a layer of pale dust along the gutter, in and out of which wander paw prints laid down by a dog or by the coyote that he saw the previous night. At the Best Western, when Godfrey knocks on the door to room 16, Rupert calls out, "It's not locked!" In the same hush puppies and rumpled corduroy suit and beige shirt and bolo tie that he was wearing for the operation at Hawk Ranch, Rupert sits at a small table with two chairs. Through reading glasses, he squints at one of two laptops that are open and in use. The bedspread has not been turned back, though it is slightly rumpled, as if Rupert had rested sleeplessly atop it for a short while before getting on with the search for Ansel and Claire Hawk. Closing the door behind him, Godfrey says, "Couldn't sleep?"
"Didn't need to."
Intrigued, Godfrey asks, "Do you ever?" Without looking up, Rupert asks,
"Do I ever what?"
"Need to sleep."
"Not when I have Hershey's Special Dark and can wash down some crank with Red Bull."
He taps a can of the high-caffeine energy drink, beside which is a bag of miniature dark chocolate candy bars.
"Crank? You're using methamphetamine?"
"Not often. Only since this case. I hate this slut. I want her dead sooner than now. I want her in-laws injected and licking my boots, and then I want them dead."
"There's another one," Godfrey says. "A conflicting detail. You never wear boots." Rupert finally looks up from the laptop, frowning, his stare as sharp as the prongs of a meat fork.
"Something wrong with you?"
Godfrey shrugs.
"Things should have gone better last night."
"Better? Hell, it couldn't have gone worse."
Rupert returns his attention to the laptop.
"When all the Hawks are dead, including her brat, I'm going to surprise that shit-kicker, Juan Saba, cut off his package and feed it to his wife before I blow her brains out."
"You sure are passionate about this. Dedicated to the mission."
"In case you haven't thought it through, it's us or them. And it's damn well not going to be me. One rogue bitch bureau agent and her bumpkin in-laws can't get the better of us. We're an ass-kicking, head-busting machine. Never been anything like us."
Stepping behind Rupert, Godfrey considers the laptop screen. An analytic program is assessing and enhancing an image taken from orbit. Changes occur with such speed that he can't understand what is before him. "Find anything? Where maybe they went on horseback?"
"I backdoored our satellites. Government, commercial. Couldn't get shit on this part of Texas after sunset yesterday."
"What about China?"
"China is all about weaponizing space and orbital surveillance, so NSA has seeded a rootkit in their military's computer network. A hacker like Rupert can dive in and float through the Chinese system at such a low level, they don't know anybody's swimming there."
"I finally found some relevant Chi-Com video,"
Rupert confirms. Although it is as dark as Satan's colon on those planes at night, the Chinese are even more interested in what America does in the dark than in the day. They fear the U.S. has mobile missile platforms that are shifted around at night. The Chi-Coms have highly sensitive look-down capability in infrared, and Rupert is working with a segment of streamed video that he cloned from their archives.
"In that meadowland, after a cool day when the ground didn't soak up heat, there's not much background infrared to filter out."
"But there's wildlife," Godfrey says.
"Most too small to matter, except deer. And deer travel in small families, usually more than two. It's largely federal land, not licensed for grazing, so we don't have to sort out a lot of cattle."
Pointing to the constantly melting and solidifying image on the screen, Godfrey says, "What am I going to see when this clarifies?"
"Horses are big. 1,500 or 1,600 pounds for Claire Hawk's mare, 2,000 for Ansel's stallion. They put out strong heat signatures, especially carrying riders and exerting themselves. I've processed this once, just now giving it a final cleanup."
When a scene resolves and freezes, it isn't like the raw image captured by satellite. It's been analyzed and enhanced, translated, to make sense to the human eye. The straight-down angle on the meadowland is rendered in shades of gray, faint, whirling feathering patterns that represent the effect of a fitful breeze in the grass. Here and there, faint reddish hazes represent ground source heat, and scattered small hot red points might be the issue of wildlife. The most prominent features in the image are two ruby-red heat signatures, brighter and larger than the others. As Rupert works the keyboard, the static image evolves into a video stream. The red signifiers move through the gray featherings toward a bisecting band without pattern, near which are clustered reddish geometric shapes representing 6 or 8 buildings.
By the time the Chi-Com satellite passed over here, the Hawks had already gone almost 20 miles from their ranch.
How do you know those aren't a couple deer?
A female deer tends to follow a male, behind and a little off to one side. And deer won't travel as directly as this. They wander. These are horses, under the guidance of riders.
But we can't know this is Claire and Ansel Hawk.
The satellite captured them at 2:10 a.m. There's not likely to be a pair of other riders out at that hour.
What are those buildings?
Another ranch. The band of gray without pattern is the state route that passes through Worstead before it gets to this place.
When the video ends, Egon Godfrey says, "That's all you have?"
Satellite's moving damn fast. You don't get a feature-length film of anything.
What if they didn't stop at that other ranch? They might have passed it by, crossed the road, and gone somewhere else. Rupert turns to the second laptop and calls up a file.
"Just finished putting this together before you knocked."
The first photo, captured from Google Street View, shows a gated entrance to a property and a sign that reads, "Longren Stables." Rupert clicks away the first photo and splits the screen for two Texas DMV images of driver's licenses, one for Chase Longren, one for Alexis Longren. They appear to be in their early 30s, good-looking in spite of the poor quality of DMV photography.
"Husband and wife," Rupert says. "We recently became suspicious of them. Maybe they're a conduit for messages from Jane to her in-laws. Nick Hawk and Chase Longren were best friends in high school."
Godfrey considers the two faces. Chase still looks like a high school jock. Alexis is a pretty woman. It's noon, almost 10 hours since the two riders on horseback, if they were riders and horses, had been captured by the satellite. Godfrey says, "Let's go have a chat with the Longrens." Chapter 18. The woman in Reseda, known as Judy White, but also as Lois Jones, neither of which was her real name, claimed to be a Syrian refugee, though her accent sounded sometimes like Eastern European Slavic, at other times flat-out Russian. She didn't answer her phone in any traditional manner.
"You have wrong number. Go away."
From experience, Jane knew neither Judy nor Lois would hang up. "We've done business before."
"I'm not in business. Read palms, tell fortunes. My gift is life mission, not business.
Enrique introduced us."
"You have wrong number. Go away."
"When I saw you a week or so ago, the last thing you said to me was go. Go where you go. You want to die, so go die."
"Was nothing personal. Just opinion. Observation. My gift."
"You're going to get two photos by email," Jane explained what she needed. "I want to stop by and get everything in 3 hours.
"Want, want, want. Everybody want. It's impossible 3 hours.
I'll pay triple the usual."
"Don't die on way here. Nobody to pay us."
"I'll do my best to get there alive."
"So you say."
Judy and Lois terminated the call. Chapter 19. This guy said he knew a guy who bought cars from Enrique de Soto, reworked wheels to outrun anything a cop might jack around in. This guy who knew a guy, he swaggered like some TV wrestling star, Enrique's product started out stolen and went for a makeover in Nogales, Mexico, where its identifiers were removed and the GPS was stripped out. The vehicle was either given a new engine, compatible to the Batmobile, or otherwise supercharged. Anything you purchased from Enrique came with a valid California DMV registration, or with one from a DMV of your choice in any Canadian province. This guy who knew a guy also knew what sweet prices Enrique charged for his merchandise, and he was dumb enough to think that Enrique kept a bank's worth of cash on the premises. Ricky DeSoto worked out of several weathered barns on a former horse ranch near Nogales, Arizona, directly across the border from Nogales, Mexico. The front barn held no vehicles, but was stocked with junk furniture and other items to provide Ricky with cover as an antiques dealer. So that morning, this guy who knew a guy came into Ricky's office without an appointment, smelling of some pussy boy cologne, obviously a bodybuilder, shaved and waxed bullet head, tattoo of a snake around his throat, wearing a loose black raincoat in a warm, rainless morning. He was accompanied by a nervous dude who resembled Mick Jagger, but even skinnier, with the bad teeth of a meth head. They evidently didn't think they looked like what they were. The one with the tattoo mentioned a good customer of Enrique's and started talking cars, a lot of shit picked up from bad movies. The meth head thought he was casual, easing around the office, pretending to admire the cheap vases and the mantel clocks that passed for collectibles. But he was moving away from his buddy and into a backup shooting position. Bullethead's raincoat didn't hang right, because there was no weight on the left side to balance the concealed sawed-off shotgun in a sling under the right side panel of fabric. Ricky didn't worry that he might have misjudged his visitors. In the event that he was mistaken, he would have no regrets. When the guy in the raincoat asked if he could smoke, just to explain why he was reaching into the right-hand pocket of his coat, Ricky stepped hard on the pedal in the knee space of his desk. A 12-gauge shotgun was mounted to the center rail that supported the desktop. The pedal drew taut a wire that pulled the trigger. The skirt on the front of the desk was a mere quarter-inch panel of masonite. At such close range, the blast chopped raincoat guy mostly in the crotch and lower abdomen and blew him down. Skinny Mick had a gun in, of all places, an ankle holster. As the fool bent and fumbled for it, Ricky drew a pistol from a holster attached to the side of his office chair and stood and shot the meth addict twice. He stepped around the desk and shot the screaming guy in the raincoat, who wasn't long for this world anyway. All the gunfire and close quarters left Ricky DeSoto half deaf. He stepped around the bodies, left his office, pulled the door shut. The would-be heist artists had arrived in a Cadillac Escalade, possibly stolen, in any case, now hot. It would have to be boxed over to Mexico, given a new identity. Because he hadn't paid some punk to boost it, there would be a good profit when it was ready for sale. He didn't work the operation alone, of course, but the other guys were in the barns farthest back from the highway. By the time he walked there, with grasshoppers springing out of the tall grass alongside the oiled dirt driveway as if to celebrate him, his hearing slowly returned, though he would have tinnitus for a while. He told Danny and Tio what had happened. They knew what to do without being instructed, and they headed directly for his office. One of the benefits of having major acreage was that you had numerous places where graves could be dug discreetly with a backhoe. Ricky didn't immediately follow Danny and Tio, but stood yawning elaborately, trying to pop the